This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. I'm Bradley Chambers. Fraser is traveling this week, so we have a special guest. Before we get started, I want to thank our sponsors for this week. The first is Jamf Software. They provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in educational organizations. It's also brought to you by Shobi. It's an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work, and then for the teachers to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, and more. It's also by our good friends at Aerohive. They unleash the power of enterprise mobility. Aerohive's technology enables organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow their business. More about them as the show goes on. So, as I mentioned, Fraser is traveling this week. He's actually speaking in a conference. So we have a special guest. It's actually a returning guest. He was on the show about a year and a half ago. It's Matthew Gass from Aerohive Networks. Matthew, good morning.
Good morning, Bradley. And it's really hard to believe it's been a year and a half since I've been here.
Yeah, my Skype list is really just like a Rolodex of who I podcasted with. And so it says, like, you last talked to Matthew Gass in June of 2013.
A lot has happened since then.
It has. And that show is always kind of funny to me because during that show, my wife walked. I was at home that day for some reason. My wife walked in and was trying to talk to me, but then I just kind of waved her off. Well, it turns out one of my dogs had gotten loose. And so she was with my two children, was trying to track our dog down. So that's always a show I remember vividly. So if you are a new listener to the show or you started listening after Matthew was on the show last time, Matthew, to me, he's like the who's who among Wi-Fi nerds in the world. So he's the director of product management at Aerohive Networks. That's still the correct title, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so you do the software that powers Aerohive's products. And that's a huge, huge role. But outside of that, Matthew is very active in the Wi-Fi community. He has served as the chair of both the Security Task Force groups at the Wi-Fi Alliance. And then you've also worked on the WPA certification to get that better adopted. And you're a fantastic author as well. And we'll put a link to your O'Reilly profile in the show notes. But you've written a number of books over the years that would be great pickups for any of our listeners. The most recent one is Building Applications with iBeacons, and we're going to talk about that more in depth later, but you also have the 802.11ac Survival Guide, the 802.11n Survival Guide, and the 802.11 Wireless Networks, the Definitive Guide. And then you also have some really old ones that would be fun for kind of some history, a T1 Survival Guide, and one for network printing. And I hate printing, so I imagine writing that book would just be painful to me to even talk about printing.
Well, and to be honest, it was pretty painful to write, too. I think my co-author and I were the third or fourth attempt to write that book for O'Reilly. It took over 2 years, and I almost gave up a couple of times. So that book is really a triumph of the force of will in wanting to be published. I look back on the experience, and I am surprised that I was able to finally get it done. And of course, it came out right before CUPS, and so I don't know how useful it is now, except as a historical artifact. And you can always tease me by saying, "Hey, Matthew, I just realized you wrote the bull book for O'Reilly, because that was the animal I got on the cover."
What is the deal with the animals on the cover?
When O'Reilly started, they were not the company we know now that is tremendously successful and really a hub for sharing information. When it came time to design the first cover, the creative director wound up coming up with several example cover designs, and one of which used a woodcut of an animal from the Dover Pictorial Archive, which, as it happens, is old enough that everything was free of copyright, thus making it an affordable choice for cover art. That was the one that everybody hated the least, and so that became the default. And then it became this tremendous branding. If you get business cards from anybody at O'Reilly now, they feature animals. And you get a box of business cards from O'Reilly, they have different animals. I've had many people give me a choice. Like, would you like this animal or this animal or this animal? It's the same card, of course, but they're printed up with many different animals. Authors are allowed to make suggestions for the animals that they would like to have. But if you don't like the animal you get the lecture I did when I said, "Hey, I don't want to be the author of the bull book." And my editor at the time said, "Well, let me tell you a story about another author who didn't like his animal. He said he didn't like his animal. He asked for it to be changed. The creative director said, no, it makes a lot of sense. He lost. Then my editor paused and he said, that author's name was Tim. You know, Tim O'Reilly. So if he's not getting his animal changed, you as a first-time author, just give up right now.
Yeah, if he doesn't win, then yeah, you're not either. That's it. Yeah, I was wondering.
What I learned from that experience was that you want to think about your animal well before it's time to ask for one, so that you have a suggestion.
That's true. Because it's funny, your Edo to 11N book has a bat on it, and then your iBeacons book has a bat on it, but yet your 11AC book looks like it has some sort of salamander or eel on it.
Right. I didn't actually have a suggestion for the animal in time on the 11AC book. Actually, I did have a suggestion. It's just that there was not a graphic for that animal. Because we'd gone with the bat theme, I asked for the Mexican freetail bat on the 802.11ac book for a couple of reasons. One is that it is one of the faster flying bats that there is, which I thought was appropriate. And second, and this is pretty cool, it's even related to Wi-Fi, that there is a colony of Mexican freetail bats that live under the Congress Street Bridge in Austin, Texas, which is the hub for many technology things, including the headquarters of the Wi-Fi Alliance. Several years ago, we had our summer meeting there, actually in the same hotel as the Texas State Democratic Convention. So our meetings about Wi-Fi were continually interrupted by people poking their heads in and saying, is this the credentialing room? Which, of course, it was not. One night, several of us had heard about the bat colony because it's really pretty stunning. The bats live under the bridge, and then at night they take off and go eat annoying bugs like mosquitoes. So several of us went down to see the bats take flight, and it's really quite amazing to see that many bats emerge from under the bridge. Unfortunately, as I said, there was no woodcut of a Mexican freetail bat. So I got the luck of the draw, and it was an eel of some sort. But at that point, I'd already had a couple of cool animals, so it wasn't as important to me to have the animal that I wanted.
And I guess if someone leaves you a bad Amazon review because of that, then it is what it is.
Yeah.
So before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It is the fine folks at Jamp Software. Jamp's been with us for, gosh, a number of years now. You guys know them as the maker of the great Casper Suite. So if you have Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs in your school, they're the one you want to talk to for mobile device management. They have a great app for teachers called Casper Focus that allows a teacher from their own iPad, not even talking to the IT person, to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV assigned to the classroom, choose and distribute iBooks, and they can even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. So if you want to learn more about Jamp Software and the Casper Suite, go to outofschool.net. This is episode 118, and they have a special link for you to use. If you'll use that, that lets them know you came to them from our show. So thanks to Jamp Software for sponsoring the show this week. So wanted to have you on for two reasons. We want to talk about, obviously 11AC is really ramping up now because we see it in the newest iPads. It's in the newest iPhone. And so that's obviously near and dear to a lot of schools' hearts, even though it's been in the Mac for a number of years. So how has wave one of 11AC from the industry perspective, how has that gone from a business perspective and a technology perspective?
It's gone very well. From a technology perspective, the first wave of products was pretty well understood, that we were applying techniques that we had applied successfully before in terms of widening channels, in terms of using a slightly better modulation. So that the technology was pretty straightforward. The question really was, can we build this in enough volume to make it cheap enough to get the kind of ramp we wanted to see as an industry? And there's no question that we've done that. Everything now is 11AC. When I was on your show last, we were talking about how great it was going to be, and we've gone out and we've proved that. I am now on my second 802.11ac phone, although that really says more about my butterfingers at an airport dropping my first 802.11ac phone than my need to get a second phone. And you see it being adopted throughout all kinds of devices. So there was some question early on about whether this was a technology that was really going to make sense in battery-powered mobile devices. And in some ways, they actually led the adoption, that having multi-stream 802.11n was pretty fast, but having the ability to go to an 80 megahertz channel and therefore double the speed on a single-stream battery-operated device turned out to be really compelling, and actually far more compelling to users than I thought it was going to be. So they really led the transition to 11AC, dragged along everybody else with them. And one of the things that that does when you talk about chipsets is that as you increase adoption of a particular standard, then the chipset volume goes up, all your variable costs go down, and you get to ride a cost curve to the point where 802.11AC is basically, it's either the same cost as what came before, or it's even a little bit cheaper. And you see that not only in devices, you also see it on the infrastructure side as well. That was something that we recognized at Aerohive, and we wanted to aggressively drive that adoption because we thought it was good for us and good for the industry to help drive that wave of adoption again. And it's been amazing. And I'm really looking forward to what's happening right now with the next wave of technology that we're looking at releasing.
Yeah, you guys were pretty aggressive with your, I mean, your original 11AC access point was the 370, and it was a great device, but it was a little bit more premium priced. And then I guess maybe 8-9 months later, you came out with the 230. It's not as, I mean, there's, you know, a few things it's missing, but it's aggressively priced. I mean, it is really to the point where you're a fool to not go with that AP, you know, versus like the old 11N ones, because it's, for what it brings you, it's very competitive in terms of pricing. We actually had my lease with Aerohive is about up with my, through my VAR, and we were looking at going to the, you know, to a 230 deployment. And so I had my VAR out yesterday. They're walking off our current network with Air Magnet and seeing kind of how we needed to change things, restructure it based on moving to 11AC and thinking through where is 2.4 gigahertz in our environment long term? How long do we do that? Do we look at certain areas of turning off 2.4 completely? And so it's really a great time. And that, again, that 230 AP is very, very well priced.
Well, and that was something that came up again and again, is that when we started off with 11AC, it was a premium product for us. And so the conversation would be about, you get these extra capabilities, but here's how much you have to pay for it. And you'd have an investment discussion over how long you expected to use the network and what applications were in use and what you expected utilization to happen, how you expected network utilization to change over the next 3 or 4 years in terms of the lifetime of the product. And it was, we sat down and we said, you know what? What drives this industry forward, and you look at the history of Wi-Fi going all the way back to when I got into the industry, and you were looking for the high speed gear, meaning 2 megabits as opposed to 1, that the PHY upgrade cycle, getting a new physical layer, is what really gets people to sit up, pay attention, and being a challenger like Aerohive, a lot of times those transitions are opportunities for you to grab awareness, grab market share. And so therefore, we said this transition is good for us. Let's stop having this conversation. Let's make a conversation instead. You can buy our older 11N access points at their list price, or you can buy an 11AC access point at 20% less. At which point, the conversation becomes really easy, because then somebody needs to have a compelling reason to buy the older product. And there are reasons to do that. They tend to be about where we designed the hardware for. But if what you're looking for is a standard Wi-Fi network indoors in an office or school type environment, it's clear that in that higher density type of environment, you want to buy the Aerohive 230. And it turned out not only to have the best price performance, it has it has a really good price period, and therefore the ROI discussion is very easy to have. And that was one of the big things we wanted to do to get us farther along that adoption curve, make wave one a success so that when we come out with wave two, people are just ready to have that. And there's a great deal of excitement about that because we've seen what wave one has done and what the ROI has been, and we're gearing up to do it all over again.
Yeah, I imagine the industry as a whole was cheering when the iPhone 6 and the iPad Air 2 came with 11ac, because that, you know, that they were the last holdouts, and Apple's typically a year later than most people on that. And so you figure any school that's looking for deployments in the fall of this next year, if they're looking to overhaul their Wi-Fi and they're looking and they're getting new Apple gear, they likely have 11ac if they're going with the full-size iPad Air 2. And so it's really a good thing for everybody. So you mentioned wave two of 11ac. Talk to us about what that is and where are we at with that?
Well, and I think the most important thing to understand is that Wave 2 isn't something that's defined in the 802.11ac specification, that you get a collection of capabilities, that you get wider channels, you get higher modulation, you get beamforming and multi-user MIMO. You get these capabilities, and what defines the technology waves is the ability to say, we're going to pick off features that have higher ROI, that they're easy for us to implement in the chip world, and then we'll take those and we'll go ahead and ship those right away, and then we'll keep working on the technologies that are a bit harder to do. And so you look at what's defining the next wave of product, it's that we're finally getting really solid beamforming with the multi-user MIMO capability. That winds up being more important than I think we anticipated as an industry going into the effort, because remember, 802.11ac, the standardization effort, started almost 10 years ago now. That multi-user MIMO works really well when you can divide up your spatial streams between multiple devices. So the fact that we've built so many single stream devices or two stream devices, they're really going to benefit from this. And then we've seen those as the go-to device in many types of customers, but especially you look at what's happened in education, and it's all about tablets. It's all about having battery operated devices you can hand out to students in the classroom. And that's really where you get a big benefit from multi-user MIMO.
Yeah, it feels like a great enhancement based on what we have now. It seems, of course, I guess in reality, we then have to wait on clients to start adopting that.
Well, and because the chipsets on both sides of the link get developed about the same time, as it turns out, and we've seen this multiple times, that although it can be a little bit slower to start the client wave, once it happens, it tends to happen very, very quickly. That you look at the time between, hey, I have an 802.11ac phone versus, what do you mean this phone doesn't come with 802.11ac? That does not take a very long time compared to how long it takes to switch over, say, the access point business, where we'll still see a long tail of the older technology being used, often in very cost-sensitive environments or where there might be particular use cases for range as opposed to density, or particularly in physically demanding environments. Some of the fun deployments we've talked about over the last month at Aerohive have been things like frozen food distribution, so access points going into freezers. So not only do you have an extreme temperature environment, but you also have big metal doors opening and closing. And that has some interesting implications for how your mesh networking functions and where you have connectivity. So when you have very specialized hardware like that, it typically is okay to change it over slower. Whereas if you're looking at, say, a typical school network, such as the ones that would be designed and built by your podcast listeners, They tend to switch over much faster because you're trying to build in advance for the client capability that you know you're going to have. And just as 18 months ago when I was on the podcast, we talked about wanting to have 802.11ac so that you were ready for the clients when they come. And so that was a year and a half ago. Most of the time, there'd be another year and a half or maybe another 3.5 years for those devices to still be in place. And you want to have the infrastructure capability to take advantage of the client wave. The same thing is going to happen with 11AC wave 2, that a number of network architects are saying, we know this is a big trend that we have to be aware of, and therefore we're going to try and put this in place as soon as we can so that in a few years time down the road, we then have the capability to serve new clients that probably, that certainly haven't been released yet, but the design process may not have even started yet because the client cycle tends to be much faster.
Would you kind of equate it to when, 11N was, 2.4, and then, there were single band APs, and then we had dual band APs, and it quickly just dual band became the way to go. Would you maybe, is that a good analogy that wave two of AC is kind of like 5 gigahertz support was to 11N?
Yeah. That in the high end infrastructure space, we always talked about 11N as a dual band solution, but it wasn't really until, the iPad came out back in 2010, and that was a dual band device, but they didn't make a big deal of it being dual band. But a lot of people who bought iPads noticed that if they had a dual band network, it just worked better because the iPad was set up to prefer to go to 5 gigahertz, which is something that we often encourage on the infrastructure side as well. So if you built a dual band network in 2009, you got a lot of extra mileage out of doing that when all of these dual band devices started to come out in 2010 and 2011, because you probably put that network in for 3 to 5 years, and partway through the life cycle, it's like, wow, cool, I got a bunch of dual band devices coming in that have just come out.
Yeah, that's always made it easy when you're talking to people about the frequencies and the iPad, because you knew every iPad from day one was 5 gigahertz. We didn't get 5 gigahertz in the phone until the iPhone 5, which was many years later. So wave two, I think it'll be interesting to watch to see how that kind of happens and see what our real world use are. I am excited about having an all AC network at my school as well. So I'm hoping in the next 2 months we'll have that in place. Of course, the great thing about Aerohive's architecture is that if you had wave one, but then you said, okay, in these certain areas, we're going to move to wave two, makes it very easy. You plug and play.
And in fact, a lot of people did that when they moved from 11N to 11AC.
Parts
that's been around forever. That goes all the way back to the AP20, which was an ABG AP that thankfully we end of life shortly after I joined Aerohive.
Yeah, I had the majority of my deployment is the 120, which I bought like 3 months before the 121s came out. It's like, just on the tail end. But, oh, well, live and learn. Before we move on, let's thank our next sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Shobee. Now, Shobee is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. I'm actually working on a guest blog for them talking about what are the tools for a paperless teacher. And obviously, Shobee's at the center of that. With Shobee, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads. They can then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly onto documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobee from thousands of compatible iPad apps or by completing assignments with Shobee's built-in tools. Shobee keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. Now, Shobee Basic is completely free, so if you're a teacher and you don't have any budget, go download Shobee Basic, get started. You can get it up and running in just a few minutes with your entire classroom. But if you want to look at Shobee Pro, they have a special deal for out-of-school listeners. If you buy 5, you get 5 more for free. So it's you get basically buy one, get one free. And to learn more about that, it's shobee.com/out of school. That's shobee.com/out of school. Again, that's for a full year. So buy 5, get 5 free. And make sure you use that URL, otherwise they won't be able to give you the discount. So thanks to Shobee for sponsoring the show this week. So 20-30 minutes into the podcast, we actually get to the main reason I ask you on is, you know, iBeacons have been one of those things that we're starting to hear more and more and more about. And you have become kind of like the thought leader in the industry on that. Again, you've got a book on O'Reilly that we'll be sure to link if any of our listeners want to go and download it. But assuming someone has never heard of iBeacons until today, tell us what iBeacons are.
An iBeacon is exactly what it sounds like. It's a beacon that helps you figure out what you're near. And it's important when I say what you're near. It's a proximity technology. It tells you what's around you. It doesn't necessarily tell you where you are. And the two concepts are often smushed together, and they don't have to be. If you were to walk into say, Aerohive, you can know that you're near Matthew Gast without necessarily needing to care about where I am. If you're trying to track me down to get me to, say, sign a book, it doesn't matter which building I'm in. What matters is how close I am and whether or not you can tackle me and shove a pen in my hand. Now, that idea of what am I next to? What can I discover about the environment around me? It's powerful for a number of reasons, one of which is that as we've started to build networks that have many smaller devices, and you can talk about this as the Internet of Things, which is in some ways a much better term than what I referred to them as, like network paperclips. They were, you'd have these things which helped you put together various networking solutions, and you'd have these small parts that were really important. That at one point they all had to have a UI. So you'd plug this thing in and you'd have a really crude web interface and it'd be kind of hard to use. And it was clear that people hadn't thought about the security of these things as they designed them. Well, what's cool now is that we all carry around a nice big chunk of touchscreen glass in our pocket. So your UI is now something that you don't have to really think about designing in a device, you know, like a thermostat or in an electrical outlet control or anything like that. You can now interact with the world around you through your phone without having to build that UI capability into every device you make. But that means that you have to discover and interact with all these things that tell you about the world around you. And how do you know you're near something? Well, there have been a whole variety of ways to do that. Sometimes you say, well, am I in range of a particular access point? But then you have to map access point identifiers into services that are near, and you got to maintain that mapping. What's nice about an iBeacon is that it's a way of saying you are here. It sends out a few numbers that identify the space. And then based on that, you can then map that in an application into what's around. And so that can be as simple as welcome to the Apple Store, which if you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch, you walk into an Apple Store. If you're using the official application, there are a number of iBeacons around all of the Apple stores that tell you which store you're in, where that store is located, and then even down to the display that you're near. So it will help you learn about the products that are that you're standing around. And that is all driven through an application running on your device. And that's cool because that gives you a nice opt-in privacy framework. A beacon transmits information. When you receive it, you can choose to do something or not. It's not like many other proximity technologies where you have to share your location and how often you visit is interesting to people doing marketing, so that it works much better in certain kinds of environments. So, for example, again, many of your listeners are school IT administrators. If you were to have an iBeacon in every classroom and you have assigned devices to students, knowing that as the device walks into as the device comes into a classroom, it then knows what classroom it's in from an iBeacon in the classroom, and that is then used to check into the classroom to automate the process of taking attendance, so that everybody who checks in Then the teacher gets a list of check-ins and says, is this the attendance for the day? Rather than going down a list and calling out names, you get that first pass done automatically. That's much easier to do with something like an iBeacon, because you can write and customize an app to your own specifications, and you are in full control of the experience, and you're well aware of all of the privacy implications. And in fact, that's something that winds up being true for any sort of application that you install, is that applications have to talk about how they use this information. And on iOS, you're allowed to control whether or not a particular application even gets information about iBeacons from its environment.
What sort of impact do iBeacons have on client devices in terms of battery life?
I haven't noticed much of anything. I've got several iBeacons around my house just for fun. iBeacon is based on Bluetooth, so it's a special application of a particular kind of Bluetooth profile. And then even within that, it's based on Bluetooth Low Energy, which is designed to work at lower power. And one of the original goals for Bluetooth Low Energy, or BLE devices, was to have life that could potentially be measured in years on the little flat coin cell batteries.
What are some current uses? You know, we'll talk about education in a moment, but like retail, and I'm really thinking about museums. I mean, is that something, are museums looking into iBeacons? Because that seems like a natural place for it.
It is. So let's talk about and set retail to the side. That this is what a lot of people talk about when they say, oh, I've got iBeacons, I can tell what somebody is standing near, I can give them valuable coupons. And while that is an application of the technology, it's one that is not particularly interesting to many end users. We already get enough advertising during the course of the day that this technology is going to succeed based on what it can do other than enable a really good advertising rich experience. So you mentioned museums, and that's a great example, that in a museum, signs and interpretive information is limited by the amount of space you have on the wall. What if near every major artifact in a museum, you had an iBeacon? So as you walk up, it says, you're near this. Would you like to know more about it? You can embed videos, you can have multimedia information, and you can have this very immersive experience that is based on not having any limits to the amount of information that you can present. And you can use that to integrate an online experience and to create a really interactive guide, far more so than the traditional, I've walked up to this exhibit, I've put in a three-digit number, and I hear this thing, hear this audio clip about it. You're able to really build a totally different kind of engagement with the collection of the museum. Another thing that can help a museum, and this is actually true of many large and complex environments, is sometimes finding stuff is hard. I was at the Louvre recently, which is a fabulous museum, and it has this amazing collection of art, and it is gigantic. And finding your way around is not at all obvious sometimes. So one of the ways you can use proximity is to say, all right, I've got known points where I have iBeacons, and then I can use that to help you find your way through particular spaces. So I can help you navigate a museum. I can help you navigate an airport or even something like a train station where you might have multiple tracks. Say, for example, your ticket knows that you are on a particular train number, and so you then look up which platform that's leaving from. You can then use the information embedded in the ticket, correlate that with an iBeacon, and use that to be guided to the departure platform for your train, even if it changes at the last minute. So it's a way of building an experience on the mobile device, tying it into the physical world, and making that different than it would be than if you had the same information printed on paper. It allows you to take information from the outside world, present it in a way that is really useful and timely and specific to where you are, and then help make that experience interacting with the physical world quicker and easier.
Yeah, I'm thinking this would be incredible, like in our local, we have a pretty nice aquarium in Chattanooga. That would be incredible. And I can think, you know, if you've got a field, a classroom full of students that all have iPads and they're on a field trip, I mean, that's an incredible environment that they can be a part of, or, you know, even a zoo, you can get more information about the animals. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, you do not have to, like, let's say you're at the museum, you do not have to be connected to their Wi-Fi network for this to work, since it's working over Bluetooth. Am I correct with that?
Yeah. So the question is, what do you do with this information? So yes, you have to have Bluetooth turned on. And then an application can choose to interact with that however it wants to. So you can walk up to the big shark display in the aquarium, and the application then can know, all right, I'm near the shark display. Now, what do you do with that? Now, you can pull up stored content on the device, or you can say, you know, go ahead and let's fetch this information so that you can either store everything in a monolithic app, or you can have it pulled from the cloud, and then use that to build the experience. So it's up to you as an application designer as to how much network access you want to require. But the iBeacon itself does not require any sort of internet access.
Before we move on, let's take our last sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Aerohive. They unleash the power of enterprise mobility. Aerohive's technology enables organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow their businesses. It's deployed in over 13,000 enterprises worldwide. Aerohive's proprietary mobility platform takes advantage of the cloud and distributed architecture to deliver unified, intelligent, and simplified, cost-effective networks. You know, one of the things we mentioned earlier is that as you look to moving to 11AC or Wave 2 of 11AC, you kind of pick and choose which areas you upgrade. So if you've got, you know, areas you're building that are lower density, you're not, you know, they've got an 11N AP that's still working fine, it's fairly new, you can leave that alone and still use the other 11AC APs in the rest of your deployment, because it's a distributed architecture. It's built just like the way your switches are, where they're not talking to a master switch. You know, with controllerless Wi-Fi, there is no controller. It just works. Each AP has a firewall built in. So if you're looking for a Wi-Fi deployment for your school, for your business, you definitely want to check out Aerohive Networks. That's AeroHive.com, and it's on the web at aerohive.com. So what about, we talk about iBeacons, you know, we talked about attendance in education. What other applications are being talked about or have you seen in education?
So being able to control the sort of access that you have. So being able to switch, say, security profiles based on whether or not you detect a particular iBeacon, so that if you were, for example, to say, when this iBeacon is on, the device should go into test mode, meaning that I only talk to a restricted set of servers to do a test. You're not allowed to Google the question, basically. So being able to control how the network acts in a particular physical space, it has been really interesting in education. And even things, and this is not an education-specific use case, but say you put an iBeacon in the library, you can, with the right level of control from an app, you can then say, when I detect that I'm in the library, I'm going to automatically go into vibrate mode so the phone doesn't ring. And you can control the behavior of the device and make it match what is expected. You know, again, assuming that you have an app to receive this and make those and make the appropriate behavior change.
One of the things that I don't think it's technically possible now, but one of the things I would love to be able to do is when like a device comes into school on Monday morning, is to initiate iCloud backup as soon as they get into their classroom. Maybe, you know, we don't assume everyone's making backups to iCloud over the weekend, but as soon as they get into the classroom, let's start making that backup. I don't think that's technically possible right now because I don't think Apple has an API to initiate iCloud backup, but that's certainly a future use case that they might possibly get that in. And you could even set it where, you know, they'd only backs up when they're, you could even stagger them. Like this set of iPads only backs up in this period, and this set of iPads backs up during third period, so you're not hammering your network uploading all at once. But, you know, there's certainly some interesting options there, as you mentioned, with testing, you know, because I guess iBeacons theoretically are really portable. So if you had a handful of just testing iBeacons, you could move those into a location that you knew was having standardized testing that day. And when those students got in there, it's you know, activates the guided access API, and it really locks down the device.
And iBeacons aren't even that expensive. So one of the early leaders in the iBeacon space is a company called Radius Networks. They will sell you an individual iBeacon powered over USB. It costs $29, and it plugs into a USB port. So that can be in your computer. It can be in your iPhone charger. And so it's possible to control the power to that device, and you can turn it on, and you can make that the first step in testing. All right, I'm going to go turn on the testing iBeacon, so you're not going to be able to send email anymore because you're going to go into test mode as a result of this. I really like the use case about iCloud backup. Once there's an API, that's easy to do. You could even have that triggered by you send a notification that indicates you've walked into the school, and then some server could then schedule the iCloud backup intelligently. As everybody checks in, then you queue up iCloud backups by triggering them through some other service. And that's the great thing about an iBeacon is that it basically says, I'm near this. And if you can dream what you want to do and you can write the code for it, you can do it. So this is a really general purpose technology that gives you the ability to do many kinds of things. And so as my last story, I'm going to bring this podcast full circle. This is not an education specific use case, but it is one of the most unexpected use cases I've seen in the iBeacon world. There's a company called PawScout, which makes a pet locator. Rather than have the traditional tag for your cat or dog that will have your phone number, and you hope that that remains your phone number for a long period of time, they actually built a tag out of an iBeacon. So it runs for a couple of years on a battery. You don't replace the battery. You don't have to monitor the battery. And it will advertise its existence throughout the world. Now, what that allows you to do is use your mobile device to figure out if you're near your pet. Well, you don't care about that most of the time, except when they get out. Now, once that happens, you then can tell them, my pet is lost. At which point, the identifying information with that iBeacon can then be looked for by anybody who has the app. So if your cat or dog wanders by somebody who has the app who you may not even know, your phone says, oh, I'm within range of this thing that I care about. And it can then help. So everybody who has this app, in effect, winds up passively looking for your pet as they go about their day. If you decide to go out looking, everybody has a device that is looking, and the phones all have GPS, which means that as, say, three or four of you are within range, you all have a GPS location and a range, and that helps give you a direction to look for, even though that's not something that is built into iBeacon. So the founders of the company are working with the San Francisco SPCA, which is how I happen to know about them, and they've built this really great lost pet locator all on iBeacons, and they had to do some very clever stuff with numerical assignment and so forth. I'm going to make that my last story in the podcast, which is if your dogs get lost again, there are even iBeacon applications to help you out with that.
Well, you think about it, what they've done is to build a social network around pet owners.
Exactly.
And so, you know, you figure anybody that has this app also has a pet, loves their pet very much, and are certainly willing to, hey, I'm getting a notification, you know, is it possible that someone else could open up this application and see, hey, this dog I'm near is lost and its owner is looking for them. I can help them out. Is that even, that's incredible. That's absolutely incredible. And you think about that, you know, what if textbooks, you know, we still have a lot of paper textbooks. What if textbooks had iBeacons built in? You lose your textbook, you can kind of figure out where it's at based on who else you can see.
Exactly. So that's a great example of the creativity which you can use proximity for. If there's anything that you want to do based on how near you are to something, stick an iBeacon to it and write the app. Anything you can dream about and write code for, you can do with an iBeacon.
So in reality, you know, someone that's in a school that says, hey, I don't know how to code anything, they're looking for a turkey solution. They've got to wait on application developers to come up with solutions. So they're not necessarily going to go and buy an iBeacon and know what to do with it today, but they're looking for a company who's building platforms and applications around that technology, just like this pet store or this pet tracking app.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this really sounds incredible. And I think one of the things that I like most about it is it's not just built around serving you more ads or tracking where you are in retail stores to push ads to you based on your location. It's really about harnessing the value of shortwave communication and helping determine locations for very useful things.
Exactly. So I'm really excited about where we're going. We have been doing some introductory partnerships at Aerohive around iBeacons to work with both hardware and software components. And it's been a really exciting ride. We've gotten to meet a whole bunch of interesting people around that. And I am really excited with what the next year will bring.
Well, Matthew, I really appreciate you coming on the show today. Obviously, we'll put links to your books in the show notes, but if people want to follow you on social networking, where can they find you?
I am an occasional tweeter at Matthew S. Gast on Twitter. I don't check Facebook as often as I used to, so you're welcome to send me a friend request, and I may get around to it in 2015. You can make connections with me on LinkedIn.
And then you're a frequent writer on the Aerohive blog as well. And so if you want to kind of keep along with some of the technical aspects of this, we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. So again, you're at Matthew S. Gast on Twitter. So Matthew, I really appreciate you coming on, and it'll be exciting to see what happens the rest of this year with iBeacons.
Indeed. I'm looking forward to it, and thanks for having me on the show.